broadcasting from the campus of Salisbury University. This is WSDL Ocean City 90.7 FM, Delmarva Public Radio. It's time now for a special writer's edition of Delmarva Today with host Harold Wilson.
Why do we write life stories? So that our grandchildren will know who we are? To deal and heal as we make our way through the prickly underbrush of divorce or the death of someone close? Is it to offer up our hard-won wisdom? To inspire the novel we are finally going to write? Or to let our words give this confusing human experience some sense of order? Why do we write these life stories? Lynn Old Schwartz. Welcome to Delmarva Today, Writer's Edition. I'm your host, Harold Wilson. Today, we're talking about life stories. You know, those family stories we've told over and over again. The you should write that down stories that we have finally decided to write down. Or those secret stories buried deep in our hearts that spill out on the paper simply because they can't be held in any longer. Life stories. The stories of our lives. We're very fortunate to have writer, teacher, theatrical producer, Lynn Schwartz in our studio today, along with her troupe of life story writers and presenters. Our program comes in two parts. First, we'll talk to Lynn about life story writing and what it means to take our stories onto the stage. Following our discussion, we'll present the radio edition of Page to Stage, What Has Life Got to Do with It? Produced and narrated by Lynn Schwartz. This presentation blends life story writing, poetry, and live music into a collage of eclectic, poignant, and funny tales. It's based on past page-to-stage performances presented at the Compass Rose Theater in Annapolis, Maryland. All the performers you will hear are in our studio today, and all their stories are true. Lynn, welcome to Delmarva today, and also welcome to your troupe of writers and performers.
Thank you. We're happy to be here.
Lynn, I talked a little about life story writing in the opening, but from an expert's perspective, what is life story writing?
Well, I think life story writing is strict. It's difficult to define it in a strict way because there's a great overlap with life writing. You have journaling, autobiography, memoir, personal essay, narrative nonfiction, letters, blogs, etc. So for me, life story writing is not a full tracing of everything that has happened in your life. It's capturing those pivotal moments and events, the turning points that caused your perspective of the world to change. Now, these are the stories that made a difference to you. Stories that have the power to inspire others to examine their own lives.
Someone who wants to sit down, who is not a practiced writer, and wants to write down a story, one of those you should write that down stories, frankly, what kind of advice would you give them?
Well, the first thing one has to do is access memories. So a lot of times people will use writing prompts, you know, the women in my family always knew, dot, 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 write 10 minutes stream of consciousness writing, and then circle what you like in that writing. Maybe there's a color red or strawberry something. Then do it again. You have a new prompt now, the beautiful red strawberries. Each time, and I would say do it three times. Each time you do it, you're digging down deeper. You're accessing your memory to the emotional core. And so that those writing prompts are very helpful to access those life story memories.
You teach life story writing, I know, as well as other kinds of writing at St. John's College. Let me ask you, how do you get your students going? What kind of prompts do you give them to get them to write?
Well, people can be a little tentative at first, and they might come in with a big story. We start with things that are very simple. I mean, you'd almost say lame. I shouldn't say lame, but almost. Just to take the nervousness, the pressure off. So we might start with, what is your earliest childhood memory? Something very simple. Usually people have that. What did your father wear? These kinds of things. And then you build up to the bigger things. And then when you have a stack of them, you can start seeing patterns and repetitions. You can start see how they connect. And you're digging deeper with each one.
So in all kind of writing anyway, it seems to me that you need some kind of arc to the writing. You need a beginning, and you kind of need to go somewhere, and then you need a wrap-up, an interesting ending. Writers who attend your workshops, how do you teach them, instead of just recounting their life events, to make a story out of that activity they're writing about?
That's a great question, and I think you can be telling your story. I always give the example. I had a man in my class who had grown up on a farm, which I love. I think those stories are so exotic and wonderful. But on the farm, the crops grew well. His wife was wonderful. His children were gifted and talented. So there were no tension. There was no tension in the piece. And I think what's important for life story writers to know is that they need to learn fictional elements of craft, because you are still telling a story. You want to follow a character arc, a narrative arc, but in life story writing, the character is you. But you still need to follow a story arc. You need to have conflict, tension, plot, things that happen. But you're using your own life, and you're putting those things together to create the story.
You mentioned the fictional elements just now, a few of them, plot and so forth. Are there other fictional elements? And draw those out a little bit. How do you find plot in a personal life story, for instance?
Well, we all have plot, if we're truthful. We all have conflict and tension. I think it's, you don't need to have a story that's linear. A lot of life story writing is mixed up, and you can have flashbacks. You can enhance it a bit. Many times in memoirs, you'll see something at the beginning of the book that says, you know, this is not in chronological order. My nine uncles are now a composite of two. But what you have to be truthful about is the emotional core of the story. But we do enhance a little bit here and there. I'm not saying lying, but to create a story that people will be interested in and move things around a bit.
It seems to me that what you're saying is that there's a thin line between the truth and a kind of embellishment that will make your story interesting to someone else.
It's about what you focus on and what you highlight on. If I say I went to Harvard and I did not, that's a lie, and it has no place in life story writing. You can do that in fiction, but not in life writing. But if you make your nine uncles, two uncles, you know, to represent that, and you're true to the emotion of the event, of course, we all view that differently, right? What I'm going to write and what my sister will write is different. So you have to stay true to that, true to your version of the events.
Well, all of our presenters today, which our listeners will hear in a few moments, are life story writers, and I'm assuming they have all told the truth. So part of the truth. So we said earlier that everything is true in the presentation. Page to stage, Lynn. What are you trying to accomplish by bringing these writers to the stage to present their work?
Well, this is something I've wanted to do for a long time. I don't think there's much opportunity anymore in any form for live performance. And there's a wonderful connection that happens between a performer and the audience. And writers usually work in isolation and don't have that opportunity. So I think it's great to get them in front of an audience to share that intimacy. I'm standing before you telling my story, my true story. And the audience wants to hear that. You don't have to be an actor. You don't have to be the best writer in the world. But I'm sharing my own experience. And I think it's a great tool for us to understand not only ourselves, but others, people who are different from us. So I think it's a wonderful shared opportunity.
Well, I think that I agree with you. But I wondered, is there a significant difference between writing for the page, for instance, and writing for verbal presentation or presentation to a group? Because there's so much communication that takes place when a story is being told that you don't have the opportunity to present in the written page.
That's correct. One of the biggest that comes to mind, of course, is facial expression. Obviously, there are differences between a playwright and a fiction writer. They tell their stories in very different ways. I think another big difference is that if you're reading written work, if the reader gets bored or gets confused, they can go back and trace the page and reread it and give the author a second chance. When you're performing your stories aloud, and telling your story through voice, there is no second chance. The listener has to get it immediately. Every word has to be clear and essential. Every word must matter.
The presentation we're about to hear is based on theatrical page-to-stage performances in Annapolis. First of all, tell us, how did you come up with this page-to-stage idea? I understand that you have presented two of them far, and, mm-hmm. and you have another one coming.
We have two more coming, one in October and one in June.
So how did you come up with this idea of bringing this wonderful group of writers and putting them up on the stage in Annapolis?
Well, that's a good question. It's something I've wanted to do in some form or another. It draws on my background. I started out as an actress and then a playwright. Now, of course, I work with students and with fiction and memoir. But it's, as I said before, it's always bothered me that the writer works in isolation and rarely has a chance to connect in person with the reader. There's a distance in that. And I wanted to give authors the chance to share their words out loud before an audience. Another big reason is that many writers, not all, many, myself included, are introverts. And a performance can be a huge creative stretch for them. So I found that this experience gives the writers confidence in themselves and as writers. And the act of having to write for performance actually makes all their writing better.
To me, writing has always been a very solitary activity. You have to sit there at your desk and reach into your imagination and your mind to come up with these words that are going to go down on the paper. So how do you get the sense of taking that kind of solitary activity you've just mentioned in standing in front of a radio microphone, which we're about to do, or on the stage before? And I understand your performances have been pretty well sold out. So how have you come at that?
Well, it's true. They have been sold out and popular. I think that it's not only fun for the performer, but as I said before, there's an intimacy, there's this connection. And I'll be honest, many of the writers that come into the workshop and move towards performance are very nervous in the beginning because it's something out of their, shall I say, comfort zone. I hate to say, but it's true. It's something different for them. And they wiggle around as if they have to visit the restroom and they're not sure where to put their hands. But eventually we coach them with that, talking about enunciating and being loud enough, not rushing your words, all these things. But really what is true in the end is to let the words, what you've written, let that carry you. Just concentrate and think about telling the story, and that goes a long, long way. So even those that aren't performing, I would say to writers, read your work aloud at home, and it will really show you where the clunkers are, and it will give you that confidence, especially with dialogue.
So all the writers wrote to a theme.
Yes.
And the theme was love?
This last time the theme was love. In October it's going to be travel.
So how did you come up with the theme of love? It clearly is something everyone experiences, but how did you come up with that as a theme for this early performance?
Well, I think in every story, and certainly in our lives, none of us gets through life without being exposed to love in some form. It's very important. It's always on the page, no matter what story we tell. And it can be all kinds of love. It can be love of a book. It doesn't have to be romantic love. As you'll see with these stories, many of them are not about romantic love.
Well, travel is coming up, and perhaps we will also experience that at a future date. But now it is page to stage. What's love got to do with it?
I recently attended a lovely bridal shower.
We passed
for my
over
niece,
bridges.
Chrissy.
To where
Chrissy
eastern
was radiant,
lights glimmered.
Mom,
I have a question.
The company was congenial.
Fiona asked,
and there were only
a
few one wedding
themed
parties. Could I be addicted?
We did play bingo.
Jesus would be waiting, and all around him would be a soft white glow.
There is a need for story in all of us, to share, to receive. Story is the way we understand ourselves and others. Life story writing insists that we tell where we come from and who we are. It takes examination. It requires us to be honest and brave. The writers who you will hear are not actors. Their writing experience varies. They are different ages and come from many kinds of backgrounds. But they all have this in common. They are courageous enough to give their words voice, to share a story of love, as they leap from the page to the stage.
I love the way we love.
I love when I hear my name in his voice.
I love listening to loud music.
I love kissing.
What did I do for love? As a young bride, I learned how to fry an egg perfectly by timing it to the traffic light right outside the kitchen window.
We all have stories, but what's love got to do with it? Everything. For it would be difficult to tell any story without including some exploration of love, some connection to another. Love's joy, its bitterness, its absence. Our experiences with love are how we come to perceive the world. It's what makes you different from me. So what does love have to do with it for you? How will you capture it on the page?
We heard echoes up the still river. A cloudy sky changing colors in a kaleidoscope. We passed over bridges to where eastern lights glimmered against ashen skies. A deafening din reverberated through my tender body into yours. As we sat by the slick black water, I caress the illuminated pallor of fine hairs on your cheek. We did not hear the rumbling trains, or the ceaseless shuffle of footsteps, or the fleeting fireworks across the dark expanse. We paused, and all I heard was the pumping, beating heart in my chest as we pressed our lips together.
I blow dry my hair upside down in front of a full-length mirror. When I bend over, everything on my face slips south. I look like an ancient female hobbit or some crone-like wood spirit you'd find perched in a tree speaking magical wisdom to speed you on your journey. If I purse my lips, it accentuates the wrinkles even more. Recently, I called my husband in to see. "You look lovely," he said. 30+ years together, and the man is still getting smarter.
Love at first sight. Unrequited love. Mad passion. A sense of well-being. What do we know about love? Do you recall how your father carried you into the backyard one night to behold the starlit sky? Perhaps it's the rundown historic house you felt you must save the instant you saw the curvy stairway, the wide pine floors. Is it how the neighbors came, bringing casseroles for weeks after your husband was a casualty of war? Or do you know love when your child races to the door to greet you, as if you are the most important person in the world, and to him, you are? What do you know about love?
I know that love means a carved-out place in your heart that nothing can change, ever.
Being kind to yourself so you can be kind to others.
When morning comes, I awake to you awaking.
I know love when my family gathers, the cousins, friends, making food, chopping veggies, kneading dough, squeezing lemons.
Love means always coming home.
We sat, the two of us, and spoke of nothing and of no one and of all the things we hadn't done and some we had. We exchanged glances and casual remarks about how the shadows that drifted in the bar intertwined themselves. We sipped at reflections and gazed lingeringly in barroom mirrors and laughed about how we were always finishing one another's sentences.
The first time I saw him, I knew he was trouble. But I loved him anyway. The goosebumps that appeared when we stood behind the library and she touched me. How my heart shattered when he returned to his wife. "I'm not writing about that," you say. "I'm leaving that part out." And certainly, if our life story writing is intended for a family record, you may not want to include long descriptions of throbbing and pulsating encounters, or the heartbreak that left you slumped on a city curb, alone and afraid. But what is your writing intention? How do you want to tell who you are, and whom do you want to tell it to? Your family? A wider audience? Is your writing best suited for a private journal, or is it a story, memoir, novel, or a poem? And what will be lost if you don't reveal what matters most? Are there those who might learn from your mistakes and struggles? Are there those who might be inspired by your triumphs? What are you willing to share?
I did not mean to hurt you, my love. You stand forlorn with moist eyes and a soft, quick voice. quivering lip. I stand opposite, with moist lips and soft, quivering eyes. Entwine your fingers in mine and let us examine one another in the concave mirror that sits on my writing desk.
I recently attended a lovely bridal shower for my niece Chrissy. Chrissy was radiant, composed, and appreciative. The company was congenial, and there were only a few wedding-themed party games. We did play bingo. The squares on the bingo cards said things like cake topper and nuptial blessing, and we covered them with heart-shaped candies. Then, in another themed activity, each guest wrote her own marriage wisdom on a heart-embellished pink card, and we read them aloud to the group. "Always eat your pineapple" was my favorite. The woman who wrote it said that her mother had shared this advice on her deathbed after hearing pineapple and feminine freshness linked on the Dr. Oz show. I wrote this on my card. "If you make each other laugh, you're golden." It got an aww. What I really wanted to write was, "You have no idea what you're getting into." The problem is that everything that seems most true to me after 30 years of generally wedded bliss would make no sense to someone who recently posted on Facebook, 100 days till we live happily ever after. I'm sure that at the time of my own bridal shower, I too envisioned marriage as a lifelong Harlequin romance novel. When you're in that swept off your feet stage where details such as laundry or money or pleasing the extended family are yet to be significant, how could it be otherwise? I still remember some marriage advice I received from my elderly auntie. She said, "If you have to work at it, it's the wrong relationship." At the time, I didn't know if she was implying that she was in the wrong relationship. Her husband, my uncle, used to quip, "Married 50 years, best 2 years of my life." But now I think, who knows how my aunt's and uncle's marriage seemed to them? A relationship can look very different on the outside than it feels on the inside. And just like having a baby, marriage has to be experienced. No one can tell you how to go about it in advance. I got lucky. My husband's a keeper. I fell for his football player thighs. Guys wore really brief little gym shorts back then. Though well-developed muscles may not be enough to base a life on, it's worked out. And we still seem to like each other, though there will always be new things to learn about him. Just recently, we were having an intense discussion, something we have time for again, now that we're empty nesters. He was explaining his reasoning concerning a decision we had to make, and I thought, wow, he really doesn't think the way I do. Marriage constantly throws you curves. Around year 15, my husband and I were walking through a mall when an 800-pound wall fell on us. For various reasons, family illnesses and transitions and assorted other challenges, it had been a rough couple of months. I had sometimes wondered whether we'd make it to year 16. But as I scrambled out from under the debris and caught sight of him, the first thing I thought was, you know, I really love him after all. So Chrissy, here are a few things I couldn't fit on that pink card. Your life together will be shaped by the living of it. You can have the best of intentions and still be less than radiant, composed, and appreciative when you're juggling kids and work and figuring out what's for dinner. Be nice to yourself and to him when you both screw up. You will change, and so will he. That keeps things interesting. If it's the right relationship, it may be challenging at times, but it will make you better. Now, sweetie, get on out there and live happily ever after.
We're going to take a short break now, and when we return, we'll continue our presentation of Page to Stage, What's Love Got to Do with It? Please stay with us. Welcome back to Delmarva Today, Writer's Edition, and our presentation of Page to Stage, What's Love Got to Do with It? I'm your host, Harold Wilson.
As we all know, love can beat us up, can bruise. The lack of love can abuse. These experiences and how we did or did not move beyond the pain inform who we become. And once in a while, it is even possible to find love in our darkest hour, in the most unexpected places. Because as Willa Cather writes, where there is great love, there are always miracles.
Sometimes, when the man would hurt me, or the others would hit me, or when my mother would lock me away in the dark closet without food, Jesus would be waiting. All around him would be a soft white glow. He would open his arms for me, and I was never afraid. I would lean against him for a long time as he folded his clouds of light around me. We didn't usually talk, but I knew that he was sad for me. I first saw Jesus on a confusing day. I found myself at the age of 5, hurrying along a busy street in Rome, holding Mother's hand, blinking at the sunshine, overwhelmed by the noise of birds flapping around statues and cars honking, people yelling to each other, "Varito! Drive straight! Hey, scusami! And basta, basta!" "Where are we going?" I asked my mother. But I had to be careful. It was always better if she didn't notice me too much. "I already told you where we're going!" Mother's voice sounded irritated, snappish. With no time to linger, we hurried past children with book bags, men in suits and ties, and women in their headscarves. I made a guess. "Are we going to school?"
"I told you that!"
I wondered if there would be food at school. Often I didn't eat. It depended on whether my mother was putting me on another fast to break my will and cause my capitulation to worship Sun Myung Moon. I didn't dare ask. Soon we came to a grand marble building with wide white steps, so common for Rome in 1966. Up we bounded, nearly tripping, and then my mother opened the tall oaken door with one hand, while with the other she swung me through, alone. "Aren't you coming with me?" This was one question too many. My mother looked down at me for the first time, right into my eyes.
"What's wrong with you? You've been coming here for months. Are you going to be trouble again?"
I knew my memory must be lost. I must have forgotten this place, too, which only exasperated my mother further. "I won't be trouble," I promised her. Then Mother let the door go, and I watched her run down the steps, leaving me alone.
The vast entryway felt unfamiliar. It smelled of dust. There was a tiered staircase to one side. As I climbed the first set of steps, I began to notice something. Something large and carved, hanging on the wall above me on the first landing. With each step, the carved shape took form until I reached the landing and turned toward the wall. Before me hung a naked man, larger than any person. His skin was a ghostly grayish white, with long rivulets of red running down across his face and his arms and his legs and from a gash in his side. A vine with little pointy sticks on it pierced through his forehead and his long stringy hair, and his head hung down past his shoulders. His arms stretched out, and great spikes had been hammered through his hands, nailing him to a long piece of wood. His legs, bent at the knees, buckled to one side of him, and another great spike had been driven through his feet. I looked on the floor, feeling sure there would be blood pooling there beneath him, but there was none. I couldn't move. I couldn't breathe. I even couldn't close my eyes. For a long time, I could not bring myself to look at his naked body. So I studied his half-closed eyes, staring at the floor. Finally, with a relief so palpable I felt dizzy, I saw there was a small carved cloth drawn over the mound and dip of his pelvis. Still, my heart pounded. I was angry, furious, that someone had captured his nakedness and his pain, forcing everyone to look at him, forcing everyone to suffer with him. Along with fury came fear, trembling fear, that he might look up. He might see me with his carved eyes, that the napkin might slip away as he pulled his wooden feet up through that spike, and as he freed his stiff hands from their nails, that he might step down and hold me captive with his stare, that he would cross the expanse between us and touch me with his nakedness. As gentle as a wafting breeze, a nun walked down the steps to me. "Afraid?" she asked. I nodded my head. "Yes." "Hold my hand," she said. The nun didn't seem to be annoyed that I felt lost and confused. "Close your eyes," she told me. As she guided me up the rest of the steps, she whispered to me, "His name is Jesus. He was nailed to a cross to die for the sins of the world." "Why did they nail him like that?" "Then he couldn't get away," she said. "They wanted to hurt him. Jesus first came to visit me when I had been locked, hungry and aching, in the dark closet where my mother had consigned me for most of the day. Evidently, I had spoken in Italian to my mother that morning, something she strictly forbade, and I had refused to give thanks to Sun Myung Moon for our food. She explained all this to me in hisses and bites as she dragged me from the table to the closet. Strangely, on that day, in the blackness, a circus ring began to emerge around me. I had been to the circus just once and found it to be loud and frightening. The elephants were magnificent, but the clowns made me shudder. Grown and sweating men, their makeup melting down their faces, and every time a clown smiled at me with his yellow teeth and his eyes like hard black marbles, my stomach clenched. "Go on," Mother would say. "Go on, see, he likes you. He's smiling." She would try to make me raise my hand to shake the clowns or to stand to greet him. But now I stood alone in the circus ring of the dark closet, empty. There were no loud crowds of shouting children or mothers yelling. There were no men hawking food and drinks and hats. And the circles of rising seats were empty. All were gone. In the middle of this ring rose a cross, preternaturally high like a tent pole, and nailed upon it was Jesus, naked and bleeding, just as he had been on the landing of the school steps. "Why are you here?" I asked Jesus. In his warm and gentle voice, Jesus said, "I am here for you. I will stay here for as long as you need me to." We waited together in silence, in that dark closet, light emanating from Jesus on his cross, but not enough to see into the dark corners. "Would you like to get down?" I finally asked him. "Do you need to go to the bathroom?" Going to the bathroom was always a problem in the closet. Most of the time I could hold it in, but sometimes I couldn't. Sometimes I had to crawl to the other side and try to hide what I had done afterwards. "No," he said with a sad smile. "No one can help me do this. Only I can hang on the cross for the sins of the world." "What are the sins of the world?" I asked in the hush of the dark ring. His head hung low between his shoulders, and looking down at the sawdust of the circus ring, I followed his gaze. I saw the litter of cigarette butts and candy wrappers, popcorn spilled from red and white striped boxes, and bits of confetti, and among the steps, imprinted into the sawdust, elephant dung. "Forgive them," Jesus told me. We both spent a long, silent time together in the closet circus ring, his clouds of light folded around me, ruminating on the sins of the world.
As the sun went there, I'll be round most anywhere. I'd be the moon when the sun goes down, let you know that I'm still around. That's how strong my love is.
That's how strong my love is.
That's how strong my love is. That's how strong my love is.
With so many memories in us, how do we recognize the story worth telling? It's the human element, the kernel of what mattered to us. What are those pivotal moments that changed our direction? When was it that we found our way? What made a difference? Many people feel that their lives are too mundane to write about. And maybe your husband has never bothered to hire an airplane to spell out, "I love you," across the sky. Maybe you did not endure a cataclysmic loss that gave you the strength to rise up and change the world. So what? Is your story more important than mine? The fact that your grandfather took you trout fishing every Sunday on Crescent Lake, or the comfort that you feel when you wear your late mother's sweater, the soft knitted arms wrapping you in her embrace, can be just as compelling as any grand circumstance. For a reader is engaged not by an event alone, but by the emotional core of the story, the universal truths that are exposed, and the reader's ability to engage and empathize, or at least grasp what makes each character tick. And in life story writing, the character is you.
"Mom, I have a question," my preteen daughter, Fiona, asked. "I was wondering, could I be addicted to music? I love listening to music. I feel empty when it's not on. What do you think, Mom? Is this an addiction?" I had to pause. These exact thoughts ran through my head when I was her age. "It's not an addiction," I reassured her. "You just love music." When Fiona was 12 years old, she cherished her iPod Nano. When I was 12 years old, I cherish the Eagles' greatest hits. I'd lay my head near the turntable speaker so I could hear every word, every note. My bedroom radio was on at all times, tuned to WPGC. It had to be. The silence would have been unbearable. Simple Dreams, a Linda Ronstadt album, became an obsession. The song Old Paint grabbed my heart. With or without Linda, I took a few chords from my elementary school guitar class, and I played. I ride an old paint, I'm leading old Dan. I'm going to Montana to throw a hula hand. Later, when I was in my teens, the Talking Heads, the Pretenders, and the Sugar Cubes came into my life. College and medical school kept me busy and broke. I wanted to take music lessons, but that felt absurd. Still, I gathered lyrics and chords whenever I could, and I kept these precious sheets in a blue notebook. The Beatles, Elton John, James Taylor, I played them all. Years later, I dropped my music. My husband and I were working, and Fiona and Casey were little, and I had to stay focused. Pearl Jam and Nirvana could not exist in this world. So I found a new music man, Raffi, the French-Canadian master of lullabies. Baby Beluga was a pretty hip tune. One morning, while folding clothes in the family room, Fiona and Casey playing around me, I caught R.E.M. on Sesame Street. Michael Stipe was dancing with the Muppets. Was this a melding of past and present? I almost cried. As our children grew, the lullabies were replaced by Disney soundtracks. All four of us sang along. A lot. Louis the Chef from The Little Mermaid sang a catchy little song. Les poissons, les poissons! How I love les poissons! Love to chop and to serve little fish! When our son Casey was 10 years old, Hey Soul Sister was the song of the moment. You don't know who Train is? He asked me. Mom, you've got to hear this, he said. I did. I took it all in. From Mraz to Maroon 5, Adele to Gaga, I was back in, tapping out the beat on the dashboard, trying to hit the high notes with my daughter. Whenever I heard Macklemore's song, Can't Hold Us, the air horn became irresistible. Last summer, Fiona, who was now 16, asked if I would take her and her friend Felicity to a music festival in Philadelphia. Mom, they close off Benjamin Franklin Parkway for 2 days. They set up 4 stages, she told me. I had to admit, the bands were fantastic. The girls were too young to go alone. They needed a chaperone. So we bought tickets and reserved a hotel in Jersey. So it's a warm summer weekend in Philadelphia, and we are at the Made in America Music Festival. My friends' voices pop into my head. Wow, Julie, you're really going? Really? That sounds like, kind of like Woodstock. You're a brave girl. Fiona, Felicity, and I walk down the rows of burrito buses and beer trucks. The big crowds haven't arrived yet, so there's plenty of room to lay a blanket on the grass under a big shady tree. We survey the scene and map out our day. We are relaxed, in the know. Toughened by the realization, we survived last night's Beyoncé concert. Before Beyoncé came on stage, Fiona and Felicity stood for hours, holding their front row spots. I was standing several rows away from the stage. I couldn't see the girls, but our text updates kept us connected as the opening acts played Imagine Dragons and Phoenix. As soon as Beyoncé appeared, people started shoving their way to the front. The girls were texting me. It's so crowded up here. People are crazy. We can barely breathe. I couldn't get to them. My text read, get out of there now. Today, it's day two of the festival. Today, I'm going to the stage with them. A few hours pass. It's time to leave the shady tree. We roll up our blankets, put on our nonchalant faces, and we move toward the stage. The girls skillfully and stealthily slide past the throngs of people, and I follow their ponytails. We stake out our spots. We are in the coveted space, right near the stage. We are crammed in, but we can breathe. Macklemore jumps onto the stage. The drums, the bass, the energy. What a performance. I even think it would be fun to dance. But I'm squished. Waving, bouncing, jumping 20-somethings are everywhere. I'm jostled left, right, up, down. Oh, I'm moving with the masses. But this is not dancing. Hours and hours of standing. My legs are aching and I am so hot. I wish I had found another mom to hang out with. I tried. But all I found were cougars. The girls are in front of me, capturing the moment on their iPhones. They are so good at this. I'm wilting. The guy next to me is a giant. He has to be 6'5", which places his armpit right at the top of my head, thank you. Nothing is going to stop him from dancing. His giant limbs are everywhere. Macklemore yells, raise those hands! Oh, great. Now, why did he tell them to do that? I whine to myself. Now they'll all be waving their arms around. There's no room for all of this. Elbows are in my face. I'm getting shouldered, stomped on. Then I hear the drums. Suddenly, my left arm is out. In a backhanded sweeping motion, I catch Giant Guy right in the belly. Move out of my way, I yell as I push him aside. This song is mine. I'm surprised at the sounds coming out of my mouth. Then my right arm makes a sweep. Move it! Fiona turns around to look at me. She looks concerned at first. Then she smiles. My arms are up. Now I can dance. And now I hear Macklemore's words. I really let them sink in. So can we go back? This is the moment. Tonight is the night. We'll fight till it's over. So we put our hands up like the ceiling can't hold us. Like the ceiling can't hold us.
Pearl S. Buck says, the person who tries to live alone will not succeed as a human being. His heart withers if it does not answer another heart. His mind shrinks away if he hears only the echoes of his own thoughts and finds no other inspiration. So what heart did you answer? What inspiration did you find? Many believe that the greatest gift I can give you is my story. I believe it is a great gesture of love.
I give you my story.
I give you my love story.
For you, I've put love on the page.
And if today I give these words a voice,
say the words and sentences and paragraphs out loud for all to hear.
Maybe my words will travel out into the world. Perhaps my ordinary life will inspire you.
For where there is love, there are always miracles.
Maybe my words will resonate with you, make you laugh, or bring you joy. Perhaps my story will nurture and comfort. Maybe you will discover a miracle.
It's written on the wind. It's everywhere I go.
Love is all around me, and so the feeling grows.
I see your face before me. As I lay on my bed, I kind of get to thinking of all the things you said.
You gave your promise to me, and I gave mine to you.
You know I love you. I always will. My mind is made up by the way that I feel.
There's no beginning. There'll be no end. Because on my love, you can depend.
So if you really love me, come on and let it show.
I feel it in my fingers. I feel it in my toes. It's written all around me. And so the feeling grows. Well, it's written on the wind. It's everywhere I go. So if you really love me, come on and let it show. Come on and let it show. Come on and let it show. Come on and let it show.
What a fantastic performance. Thank you to all of you. Absolutely beautiful. The voices you heard are those of Joanne Hagemeyer, Paula Novish, Julie Scherer, and Simon Ward. And a special thanks to our musician, Tom Gay, who plays with them Eastport Oyster Boys, as well as other groups. The next Page to Stage performance at Compass Rose Theater in Annapolis is scheduled for October 11 and October 12. Tell us just a moment, what you have coming up with that performance?
Well, it's similar to this, then it's life story writing, putting area writers on stage to tell their true stories. It's, as I said earlier, it's themed around travel. That doesn't mean necessarily it's travel to a physical destination. It may be a psychological location as well.
Well, visit the Compass Rose website for tickets, www.compassroseteater.org. And do it now. Performances are usually sold out. Okay, all of you writers and performers out there, if you're interested in participating in future Page to Stage workshops and performances, contact our narrator, our producer, Lynn Schwartz, at www.writers.com. And I really just have to say thank you again to all of you. Your writings are beautiful. Your performance was fantastic. Thank you. I'm your host, Harold Wilson. Thank all of you for listening to Delmarva Today, Writer's Edition.
You've been listening to a special Writer's Edition of Delmarva Today with their host, Harold Wilson. This program is produced on the campus of Salisbury University for Delmarva Public Radio. Christopher Rank is your audio engineer. Mary Seaman is the volunteer producer. Visit our website, delmarvapublicradio.net, for podcasts of this program.